Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. We'll look at two historic journeys on today's program. One ended at Auschwitz and death, the other on the surface of the moon and glory. We'll begin with the luxury liner SS St. Louis, a vessel that in 1939 was supposed to signal freedom from Nazi Germany's unfolding evil for nearly 1,000 German Jews. Destined for Cuba, they were denied entry there, then in the U.S., then in Canada, forcing the ship to return to Europe just months before the start of World War II. Aboard the St. Louis were Martin Goldsmith's grandfather and uncle, whose return to Europe ended with their deaths at the infamous Auschwitz extermination camp. Goldsmith, who was born in St. Louis and who was once a host on NPR, was drawn to the story and committed to retrace the journey that led his relatives from Germany to Cuba to France to Auschwitz. The result is his new book, Alex's Wake, A Voyage of Betrayal and a Journey of Remembrance. Martin Goldsmith joins me by phone to talk about the book and that story. Martin, it's so nice to have you with us.
Great to be with you, Don. Thank you so much.
You know, I found no small irony in the fact, and I suppose you did too, that you were born in St. Louis. Your mother played with the St. Louis Symphony for at least two decades, a little more than two decades, but that your relative's ill-fated journey began aboard a ship named St. Louis.
Yes, Don. Yes, that irony has certainly occurred to me, the fact that they were so close to freedom. They were within just a couple of miles of Miami, so close that on board the St. Louis they could see the lights of Miami at night, but that was not to be.
And, of course, they had to turn back and bypass those lights and those countries that I mentioned, the United States and Canada. Before we continue with that story, though, Martin, I'd be curious to just get your take on what's going on along the U.S.-Mexican border now. There's, you know, is that analogous in any way to your story?
Well, I think it is, actually. It's been really disheartening to see this is the self-proclaimed land of opportunity and the place that, its most famous statue proclaims, give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. And certainly those poor, unfortunate children from Central America who have gone through so much difficulty already, the fact that we are, at least some Americans are turning their backs on them, does to my mind, bring forth unhappy parallels to the St. Louis and the fact that this country turned away more than 900 Jewish refugees in 1939.
You know, you mentioned that famous statue, the Statue of Liberty, of course, and a very famous cartoon was produced as a result of the St. Louis voyage, which you show in your book, the statue holding up a keep out sign.
Right. Fred Packer, who went on to win the Pulitzer Prize for his political cartoons, illustrated the Statue of Liberty, its head turned away, a keep-out sign hanging from the arm that she bears, holding the torch, and before her, the Jewish refugee ships, sails by unheeded. It's a very, very powerful image.
Martin, what motivated you to make this commitment to retrace your relatives' footsteps? They died at Auschwitz 10 years before you were born.
Yes, Don. Well, as I write in the first chapter of the book, setting forth, it was a combination of events. My father's death at the age of 95, after obviously a long life, which had a very sad diminuendo at the end, as he was a victim of Alzheimer's disease. And then less than a year after that, the shocking death of my brother, Peter Goldsmith. He was 3 years older than me, and he was only 60 years old at the time. And those two things were shocking, and I decided that as a means to come to terms with the death of my father and my brother, I would write a book about my father's father and his brother. But as you alluded to, Don, there were other sort of irrational aspects to the decision. Alex Goldschmidt, my grandfather, and Helmut Goldschmidt, my uncle, were murdered in Auschwitz in 1942, 10 years before I was born, and yet I had somehow inherited my father's guilt. My father, who had come to this country in 1941, making $16 a week at a rather menial job. My mother was also employed as a domestic, cooking and cleaning for other people. They had very little money, and they tried to save Alex and Helmut by sending them money. They were already in these French camps in 1941 and 1942, but they did not manage to save Alex and Helmut. My father was obviously afflicted by a great deal of guilt, and I think he unwittingly passed that on to me. And a really important driving force in my taking the six-week, 5,700-mile journey in the footsteps of Alex and Helmut was an irrational desire to save them, even though they had been murdered 10 years before I was born. I guess I had this idea that if I bore witness, if I set foot in all of these places, it would at the very least show an attempt to save them, and that was at the heart of this journey.
You know, you speak of your father's guilt, and I don't want to get too far ahead of his story, but as long as it's come up, I found that the most touching, even heartbreaking part of your story, and that being that your grandfather and uncle were writing letters to your father and your mother, who were preoccupied to some degree by their own lives and the fact that they had to make their lives work here, that the grandfather and the uncle were terribly depressed by the lack of communication at one point.
Yes, they landed in France. Again, it's sort of a long, convoluted story, but to sum it all up, at the end of the voyage of the St. Louis, they disembarked in France in June of 1939, and they spent the next 3 years being sent from one camp to another, from Boulogne-sur-Mer, where they landed, to Martigny-les-Bains, to Sion, to Montauban, to Agde, to Rivesaltes, to Les Milles, to Drancy, to Auschwitz. And by the time my parents managed to get to this country in 1941, Alex and Helmut were first in Rivesaltes in southwestern France near the Pyrenees, and then in Les Milles in Provence. And from there, they sent letters to my mother and father. And the refrain in their letters was, you know, these are terrible conditions under which we're living. We've lost many, many pounds. The food is terrible. The conditions are terrible. It's hot in the summer, cold in the winter. Please do everything in your power to get us out. And again, my mother and father were recent immigrants to this country. They were trying to make a living. They were doing their best to occasionally send money via the Quakers to Alex and Helmut in France. But they would occasionally, yes, go months or weeks without writing. And yes, Alex and Helmut were quite saddened by that and eventually angered. And in the very, very last letter that my father received from his father, Alex wrote, you know, we've described our conditions to you many times. This will be the last time. If you do not move heaven and earth to get us out of here, that's up to you, but it will be on your conscience. And I'm sure that letter was ringing in my father's ears probably for the rest of his life.
No doubt. I can't imagine that it could not have been, given all of those circumstances. You know, Martin, some people might be confused by the fact that you're referring to your uncle and your grandfather as Goldschmidt, and your name is Goldsmith. But that, too, is a fairly typical story, isn't it?
Yes. When my father arrived in this country in June of 1941, after a few days, he changed his name legally from Goldschmidt to Goldsmith. His given name was Günther Ludwig Goldschmidt, and when he arrived, he thought that was a bit too Germanic for the times, so he changed. He took his first name Günther and turned it into his middle name Gunther, changed Goldschmidt to Goldsmith, and for a new first name, he adopted the first name of the first president of his new country, George Washington. So he became George Gunther Goldsmith.
Name changing was something that was quite common as people came through Ellis Island, I know.
Exactly.
That was
exactly
that,
right.
That happened probably hundreds of thousands of times.
Right.
Why did the United States not let them in while they were aboard the St. Louis?
Well, it's a long and somewhat complicated story, but it basically comes down to the fact that here it was early June 1939. Here were 937 Jewish refugees on board this ship. The country was under the rule of the 1924 Immigration Act, an act that had quotas stipulated for various countries. And the idea was, well, if we let these 937 passengers into the port at Miami, that means we'll have to push 937 people who had legally filled out all the correct forms and done all the paperwork and done all of the correct legal maneuverings, we'll push them farther back down the line. And A, that wouldn't be fair to them. B, it would create a precedent, and suddenly there will be ships from all over the world coming to dock in Miami and Baltimore and New York, and we just can't have that. And, of course, there were other reasons as well. President Roosevelt was beginning to, I at least think, about running for what would be an unprecedented third term as president in 1940. He didn't want to get too far out of immigration opinions in this country. The country was somewhat anti-Semitic at the time. I quote in the book a number of polls which show that a majority of Americans didn't think that Jews were like the rest of us. They didn't deserve the same rights as everybody else, that they probably should be restricted in some way. This was the era of restricted country clubs and restricted hotels and so on. So there were lots of interlocking reasons why the Roosevelt administration found it prudent to not actually refuse the St. Louis landing rights, but just to not approve the request of Gustav Schroeder, the captain of the St. Louis, for permission to land.
Again, it's easy to find certain parallels with what's going on in the country today.
It is indeed. And you know, if one needs to find a defense of the Roosevelt administration, they also, I mean, they were a part of the negotiations which led to this deal, which meant that the St. Louis passengers on their return to Europe would disembark in either England, France, Belgium, or Holland. At least they would not be returned to Germany. And in June of 1939, while things obviously were getting increasingly tense, A, there was no definitive proof that war would break out in September of 1939, and there certainly was no evidence of the immense depths of depravity that the Nazis would sink to in their final solution.
And as it turns out, those who were allowed to enter England at that time, just a couple of hundred or so, as I recall, maybe 180 or 200 or so, they are probably the only ones of that entire passenger list on the St. Louis that survived the war.
Well, some of the people who landed in France or in the Low Countries did survive, but of the roughly 930 people who were on board the St. Louis, a good 250, 260 of them were murdered by the Nazis.
Well, let's take a break on that note and come back and continue our conversation with Martin Goldsmith. He's the author of Alex's Wake, A Voyage of Betrayal and a Journey of Remembrance. It was his journey in which he followed in the footsteps of his grandfather and his uncle who were killed at Auschwitz during World War II. Back to continue our conversation in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Welcome back. We'll be continuing our conversation with Martin Goldsmith, author of Alex's Wake, A Voyage of Betrayal and a Journey of Remembrance, in just a moment. But first, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. Candidates for St. Louis County Executive will participate in a forum tonight held by the League of Women Voters. It may be one of the only opportunities for voters to see Democrats Charlie Dooley and Steve Stenger together before the August 5th primary election. Senator Claire McCaskill of Missouri is introducing legislation that she says should help fix problems at the Department of Veterans Affairs. McCaskill says mid-level managers at the VA who mistreated whistleblowers should be fired. And federal judges have ruled that a Missouri inmate's execution can take place after 6 o'clock this evening. John Middleton was scheduled to die 1 minute after midnight this morning for killing three people in rural northern Missouri in 1995. With less than 2 hours to go before the execution, a federal judge granted a stay, ruling there was enough evidence of mental illness that a new hearing should be held. Join St. Louis Public Radio this afternoon for local and regional news and throughout the day on our website at stlpublicradio.org. Now back to our conversation with Martin Goldsmith. Martin, you know, I found your book really kind of a refresher course on that one very dark chapter in history. And one of the things that I knew very little about were the number of camps in France. And your grandfather and your uncle were those that were left off in France. Others went to England, Holland, and Belgium, as you indicated. But I had no idea there were so many camps for Jews in France.
Well, yes, Don, I think that is a part of that time of history that I wish were better known. I think many of us know the names Bergen-Belsen and Dachau and Treblinka and Auschwitz, but I think it's important that people know the names Gurs and Agde and Rivesaltes and Les Milles and Drancy. There were literally thousands of camps built by the French. Some had been constructed earlier to house refugees from the Spanish Civil War, but there were a number of camps that the French, the Vichy government, built not at the behest of the Nazis, but of their own volition. Les Milles, for instance, the camp where my grandfather Alex and my uncle Helmut were held just before they were sent to Drancy and then to Auschwitz. Les Milles was built entirely at the behest of the French themselves as a place to house what they called the undesirables, the people who were targeted in the Statut des Juifs of October 3rd, 1940, rules that were essentially copied down almost word for word from the Nuremberg laws that the Nazis passed in 1935. So the Vichy government built all of these French camps, and yes, there was a huge network of them, and my grandfather and uncle were just two of the many caught up in that awful web.
It should be pointed out they were not extermination camps per se, but really camps to just warehouse these folks. Although some did die, the treatment they received at the hands of the guards was a little better than what could be expected in the East.
You're right. I mean, yes, there were no gas chambers in these camps, no electrified fences or anything like that, but as you say, the conditions were wretched, and in Rivesaltes, the camp where Alex and Helmut were, before they were sent to Les Milles, there was an International Red Cross delegation sent there, and in his report, one of the Red Cross people wrote, "No self-respecting zookeeper would treat his animals the way I have seen these people treated in Rivesaltes." So the conditions were just awful, and many, many people did die there from malnutrition and exposure and disease.
You know, one of the things that occurred to me in reading about these places in your book, I asked myself, I wonder if we have over-romanticized the role of the French Resistance to the point where if we made movies, and of course what those folks did was valiant and heroic, but there was this other part of France that we admittedly knew so little about.
Well, I was fortunate, my wife and I were fortunate to meet some wonderful people along the road. Again, we spent 6 weeks and traveled more than 5,700 miles tracing the route of Alex and Helmut. And along the way, we met some extraordinary people, among them a fellow by the name of Jean-Claude Rouillet, whom we met in Montauban, who helped us learn that Grandfather Alex and Uncle Helmut were held in the courtyard of a former cookie factory in Montauban, held there for about a month before being sent to the Camp Agde. And Jean-Claude and we took a little spin in the countryside one afternoon, and we came to this very beautiful medieval town, and we were walking through it and admiring the old clocks and cathedrals and the winding narrow streets. And in the square, the town square, we came upon a monument to the resistance, and I pointed that out to Jean-Claude, and he sort of snorted and rolled his eyes and said, "Oh, yes, in every town across France, you can find monuments to the resistance. Obviously, every single French citizen was a member of the resistance." Hmm. he was a bit cynical about all of that, and it is true, I think, and it's certainly understandable that the French, looking back today, want to remember those who resisted the Nazis and who resisted the Vichy government. But many people were members of the Vichy government. Marshal Pétain, when he toured France, was cheered lustily by many of the citizens of France. So they do have something to answer for, I think.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned that. I lived in Germany for 6 years. And during the 6 years that I was there, I only met two people, two Germans, and I had many acquaintances who had any kind of connection with fighting against the Allies in World War II. Everyone I met fought in the East. That was their way of kind of distancing themselves from the Americans that they met.
Well, I also, for what it's worth, I've written in the book that the Germans have done a great deal to acknowledge the black mark against their name in the book of history, in the book of life. They have erected so many memorials to the Holocaust. There are stumble stones memorializing Jewish homes, former Jewish homes in German cities. They've really done a marvelous job in memorializing things. But oftentimes you will come across signs that really recognize that indicate the tone deafness of certain people. And in Germany, there's this beautiful synagogue on a Grosser Hamburger Straße, from where a number of Berlin Jews were rounded up and then sent to the east. And on the front of this synagogue, there's a sign which says, in effect, and I'm exaggerating to make a point, but they give a whole history of the synagogue. And then essentially they say, between 1933 and 1945, men from Mars came down to rule Germany, and we have no idea what happened during those 12 years, and it was really terrible. But then after 1945, things were good again. So there is a real desire on the part of many to turn their backs on certain aspects of their history.
And there were at least a couple of occasions during the trip you and your wife were taking, retracing these steps, that were very frustrating for that very reason. Certain people just didn't get it at all.
Right. We were in the village of Agde, which is this very beautiful place right near the shores of the Mediterranean Sea. And that's a camp that was originally built to house refugees from the Spanish Civil War. And after it was used as a place to hold Jews, many refugees from Southeast Asia were there. And there is a monument to the Camp Agde, but the marker says in French, "Here, thousands of people stayed on their march toward freedom." And we just thought, when we saw that, it was just infuriating to think of people passing by who didn't really know the history of Agde, to think of, for instance, Grandfather Alex and Uncle Helmut staying there in their march toward freedom.
You know, your book ends with a memorial and a tribute that we can certainly talk about now while we're on this subject, because this was something that was very, very important to you, but you were conflicted over whether such a marker should be made in the in a house once owned by your grandfather.
My grandfather, Alex, was born in 1879. He came from a long line of horse breeders and horse traders, but he didn't want to go into the horse business. He moved to the relatively larger town of Oldenburg in the northwestern part of Germany in the very early years of the 20th century. And in 1911, he established a woman's clothing store, the Haus der Mode, the House of Fashion, and it did very, very well. He then marched off to join his regiment, fought in the First World War. He was awarded the Iron Cross First Class. He miraculously escaped injury in that horrible conflict, came back to Oldenburg, and then in 1919 bought this very, very beautiful house. His business had done so well that he was able to afford this gorgeous house right by the former ducal gardens of the Duke of Oldenburg. And he lived in that house with his family comfortably for the next 10 years, more than 10 years, until 1932. In 1932, the state of Oldenburg became the first German state to actually elect a Nazi leadership, and in the autumn of, late autumn of 1932, two representatives of the Nazi Party knocked on my grandfather's door and said, "You have to sell this house." And he was forced to sell the house under great duress. He received a little over 10,000 marks for the house, which was about $14,000. And in fact, the house was probably worth $3 or $4 or $5 or $6 million at the time. So when my wife and I first came to Oldenburg on our trip retracing Alex's steps, we met the current owners of the house. They had no idea that it had once been owned by my grandfather and that he'd been forced to sell. And they offered to put up a plaque saying, in effect, this house was owned by Alex Goldschmidt, and he and his son and were murdered in Auschwitz, and his wife and daughter were murdered at the Riga ghetto. And I provisionally accepted the idea, but then that night was thinking, well, will this sort of let them off the hook? Will this let all of Oldenburg off the hook? And perhaps what I should have said is, I'll give you $20,000 and you give me back my house. But in fact, as a postscript or a coda to our long journey, we returned to Oldenburg in September of 2012 to see the unveiling of the plaque that's on that house, which really was a wonderful, wonderful thing. And afterwards, there was a gathering at the Friends where we were staying. And I realized at the time that it was similar to what the Irish call a wake. And so I thought that it was meet and right to think of that as Alex's wake, which was sort of one of the two meanings of the title of my book.
What was the other one? Did it deal with your following in the wake of their journey?
Exactly. I mean, the fact that for so many years I have felt like emotionally I was traveling in Alex's wake. I mean, the fact that he was on this ocean liner, which eventually led to his murder, and the fact that my father had felt so guilty about the fact that he had been unable to save his father and brother, and that somehow I had inherited those feelings of guilt. I was struggling in Alex's wake for so many years, but then it was very, very much mollified by the wake that took place following the unveiling of the memorial plaque on Alex's house.
Sure. We have a phone call that I'd like to take at this point. Martin Goldschmidt will be joined by Kent in St. Louis. Go ahead, Kent.
Martin, good afternoon. My name is Kent Hirschfelder. I am chairman of the Holocaust Museum and Learning Center here in St. Louis. And I have found your story of the St. Louis to be very, very interesting. We have an exhibit, or as part of our permanent exhibit, is the story of the St. Louis in our museum, and we always talk about it, and people always ask if there was a connection to the names, and unfortunately, there was not. But one interesting anecdote, you may be aware of it, was as the ship was off the coast of Miami, the captain was desperate to find a place to land, and he was emailing everybody or every town in the country with the name St. Louis. To see if, not emailing to them, then it was a telex, to see if they could, at least put some pressure on Washington to allow them to land. And that letter, or telex, went to the then mayor of St. Louis. We've been looking for that, but we've never been able to find it. But it's an interesting anecdotal story about St. Louis and the ill-fated ship.
Well, and I certainly know, as I write in my book, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch wrote at least one ringing editorial on behalf of the refugees on board the St. Louis, saying, "Surely this country is big enough that we can afford to bring 900 of these unfortunates into our country." So the St. Louis Post-Dispatch certainly did its part for the refugees.
Sadly, as you were talking a few minutes ago, in your discussion with Don Marsh, it was a very, very divisive topic at the time for all the reasons that you mentioned. As I said, it's too bad that the ship had to return. There was a book written, and again, I don't know if you spoke of it because I haven't heard the entire discussion this afternoon. There was a book written by a researcher at the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. And I think he located and was able to track down the fate of every one of the 900-plus passengers on the ship.
Exactly, yes. That book was published by the University of Wisconsin Press about a decade ago. And yes, he was actually very instrumental in my learning the eventual fate of my uncle Helmut. I at the time, about a decade ago, I wasn't sure exactly what happened to Helmut, but thanks to that archivist at the U.S. Holocaust Museum, I did learn that my uncle Helmut was tattooed with the number 59305 and was eventually murdered in Auschwitz on October the 9th, 1942.
Kent, we thank you so much for the call. Martin, in terms of your gathering information, accurate information, to know exactly where your relatives were at any given time, how did you come up with this information?
Well, as the gentleman has mentioned, the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum was so very helpful. They are doing such incredible work now and with representatives working for them in Europe, some of whom I met during this long journey. They have combed through all of the records, and fortunately, for history at any rate, the Germans were very, very good at leaving these sorts of detailed records. And so the U.S. Holocaust Museum was very helpful. That gentleman I mentioned, Jean-Claude Drouillet in Montauban, assisted me by showing me where to look in the police records of Montauban. When I arrived in Agde, the local historian there was extremely helpful. The people in Rivesaltes and Les Milles, who are turning, and in the case of Les Milles, have turned those sites into memorial museums, they were extremely helpful. The Shoah Museum in Paris was extraordinarily helpful. So if you know where to look, there are always people who will be doing their very best to help you discover these sorts of pieces of information.
What sort of a bond, Martin, do you believe that you were able to make with Alex and Helmut Goldschmidt?
Well, Don, that's a very profound question. I do think, I mean, as I write in the book, one of the first things we did when we picked up our rental car at the airport in Zurich at the beginning of this six-week, 5,700-mile journey, we scotch-taped photographs of Alex and Helmut to a little space just above the rearview mirror of our rental car, and so they were with us constantly in our journey. And when we finally, at the end of those 6 weeks, and when we arrived in the unhappy Polish town of Oświęcim, which in German is known as Auschwitz, and we went to the memorial of the concentration camp there, we took the photographs of Alex and Helmut, and first in Barracks 20 in Auschwitz, where Helmut died, we placed his photograph, and then in the ruins of the crematoria in Birkenau, where Alex was gassed upon his arrival in 1942, we placed his photograph and some wildflowers that we had found in a nearby field. And we thought, well, this is the burial that Alex and Helmut never received. And I think being able to do that allowed me to say goodbye to them in a way that I hadn't been able to for the first years of my life. And I think by traveling in their footsteps, by breathing the air they breathed before they breathed their last, and by seeing what they saw, and at least being on the same in the same general area where they were, it did forge a real bond between me and them, and between my dear wife Amy and them as well.
Did it ultimately give you any comfort or relief from the feelings of guilt that kind of permeated your family?
Yes, certainly. I mean, at the end of the journey itself, as I write in the final chapter of the book, I was at first seized by a great depression because I thought, well, the punchline to the story is that they were murdered in Auschwitz, and my aunt Eva and my grandmother Toni were murdered in the concentration camp in the ghetto at Riga. But then once we did travel to Oldenburg the second time for this memorial plaque, and the plaque says in German that essentially in this house the respected Jewish businessman Alex Goldschmidt lived from 1919 until 1932. They were forced to sell the house to the Nazis, and Alex and Helmut were murdered in Auschwitz. Antoni and Eva were murdered in Riga. And then below that, there are two lines in English from a poem I discovered by Emily Dickinson. The lines read, "Remembrance has a rear and front. Is something like a house." And seeing that plaque on the wall did for me at any rate, convey a certain degree of immortality to Alex and Helmut, and that has relieved me of a huge burden of guilt and sorrow that I carried for so long.
I've got to stop it right there. Martin Goldsmith, thank you so much for being with us. The book, Alex's Wake, A Voyage of Betrayal and a Journey of Remembrance. I highly recommend it. Thank you so much, Martin.
Thank you so much, Don, very much.
Coming up, the journey of 45 years ago that held a much different outcome. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.